Hey, this is Mark Butler, and you are listening to a podcast for coaches. I have in mind that I want to create a multi-hour philosophical analysis of the industry of coaching. And if you know me outside this podcast, and if you know me through this podcast, you might know that I have a tendency to overthink. And I have a tendency to take what is simple and make it complex. Now, there's certain areas of my life where that has really served me. But where it doesn't serve me is when you're trying to create a podcast episode that is actually immediately applicable and useful to this handful of people you have in your audience. So I've successfully redirected myself away from that multi-hour analysis, and I've boiled it down in my mind to one topic. And that's why the episode is called How to Read a Sales Page. Now, maybe somebody sent you this podcast. Maybe you don't know who I am. Let me take just a second and tell you why I think I'm qualified to comment on how you should read a sales page or how you can read a sales page. I wrote my first sales copy in around 2007 or 2008, and it was actually to sell coaching. In fact, I remember how hard I worked on it and how flowery it was and how dramatic it was and kind of laughed, but it did work. We sold some coaching. I had a business partner at the time. We sold some coaching, and then I went on to have the experience of writing sales copy that generated, I think, a total of about $2 million in the period between around 2008 and the beginning of 2013. The product that copy sold was a membership. A bunch of people went through that membership. And most of the $2 million I referenced was generated from that thing. And since 2012, 2013, somewhere in there, my copy that I write has not really had a sales intent. It hasn't had to because of my business model. So I haven't written a lot of persuasive copy even in the last 10 or 12 years. But starting in about 2014, 2015, I started to be an advisor to other coaches. Now, advisor can mean a lot of things. In my case, it meant that I was their bookkeeper in many cases. I was their CFO in some cases. In other cases, I was sort of a thought partner, a strategist, where we were talking about how they were going to do what they were going to do. And in some cases, I was more of a pure life coach where we're talking about their mindset, their relationships, their emotional state. But what it gave me was the opportunity to be inside a bunch of businesses at a bunch of levels. I've worked in businesses that generate $100,000 a year. I've worked in businesses that generate $2 million a year. I worked in one business that generated TED. I don't know what it generates now, but at the time, it was generating $25 million plus in a year. And it let me see inside and outside. So I could see the copy that's being written and I can have a personal relationship with the person writing it. I can talk to them about the product they're selling and understand in a one-on-one setting what their psychology is around their own product. And then I can read the copy and see how they sell it. Now, I'm happy to say, and I want it to be clear, that I'm not bringing you a cynical or a hypercritical view of this whole topic. I have been fortunate. I've never in the 10 plus years now that I've been interacting with and supporting other coaches, I've still never come across a client who I believed had any ill intent whatsoever. The way they did what they did might not be how I would do it, but I've never, ever worked for a client who I thought was lying or intending to deceive or intending to harm. So I'm not coming to you today to say, oh, this is a takedown. This is a takedown of anybody or of any way of being. That's not what this is. This episode is an attempt to have you approach persuasive content online, particularly content that attempts to sell you training or sell you experiences, and to approach that persuasive material in a way that makes it so you're less likely to regret your decision later. Because I can hold two ideas at the same time. One idea that I'm able to hold is that training and community are powerful. They're positive. They help people transform their thoughts, their emotional states, their ways of being, and produce great new results in their life. And I find it very easy to hold that thought and to believe that. I also hold the belief that the hopes, the dreams, the aspirations, and in too many cases, the self-confidence of so many people are buried in an invisible graveyard that we don't hear very much about. And the reason they're buried in that invisible graveyard is because they didn't take a thoughtful approach to the persuasive material that they encountered. They made one purchase and then multiple purchases, and then they formed a habit of purchasing that led to regret, self-doubt, loss of confidence, shame. And so since I have both of those ideas in my head, both of those strongly held beliefs in my head, I bring this episode to you not to critique anyone or anything, although I suppose my opinions will come through, but to try to create a tool that a person might come back to multiple times to help themselves engage productively with whatever persuasive material they're seeing, so that they are less likely to regret the decision later. See, the industry does an amazing job with working on how they can be happy about the decision later. But the industry doesn't do much with the acknowledgement that there is such a thing as making a decision that later on you very honestly regret. That's not coming from a place of blame or from a victim mentality. It's just you coming back to a decision later and saying, I'm not happy with the way I made that decision, and I'm not happy with the results that that decision produced. In addition to the invisible graveyard where some people's hopes, dreams, aspirations, and self-confidence are potentially buried, we also have real financial consequence. We have people walking around, in some cases, with tens of thousands of dollars in debt that they don't have any clear path to paying off because they didn't know how to engage productively with persuasive material online. We do this thing in the industry, by the way, where we tend to be very all or nothing about this topic, which is funny because as coaches, we really discourage our clients from all or nothing thinking. But when we talk about offers we make or offers that we've made in the past, we tend to be very all or nothing. We tend to say things like, well, if you're all in, if you go all in, then you will succeed. You cannot fail. And if a person doesn't get a good result, we tend to be very all or nothing about that. We tend to say, well, if you'd put in the effort. And we tend to say things like, well, there was a guarantee, there was a money back guarantee, and you didn't meet the requirements of the money back guarantee. So it's your fault. There is a temptation to blame the client in our industry, which I think is very unhealthy. We have a tendency not to acknowledge that all human relationships are entered into with some level of ignorance. There's confidence, but there's also ignorance. So there's hope, but there's not certainty. And I'm not just being abstract and philosophical. Look at it this way. We have to acknowledge that sometimes a person makes a decision that isn't the best decision for them. There are scenarios where we, in our effort to be persuasive and in our effort to give the highest possible service, we invite a person into a relationship that they actually don't have any business getting into. But once the money changes hands, there's a weird dynamic that can be introduced where we say, well, you gave me the money, so now the contract is final and there's no going back. But we're not acknowledging that there's a real possibility that that person is not better off for having entered into that contract. That doesn't make us a liar. It just means that every relationship is started with some uncertainty. And just because money has changed hands does not negate the uncertainty that was there. So in the same way that it makes sense for a person to say yes to a program, it makes sense for them to back away from that same program when they have new information. And as easy as it was for us to take their money, it should be just as easy to give it back when we have new information. I know it's very opinionated. I'm bringing strong opinions to that, but I would ask you to consider it. It's why since the beginning of having anything that looks like a coaching business, my refund policy has been, if you ask for a refund, I will give it. It doesn't need to be named in some fancy way. It doesn't need to be based on 61 pages of legalese. I've never had a contract. I will never have a contract. If you ask for a refund, I will give it. that has led at some points to me giving refunds that I don't think were deserved, that I think I earned the money that I was paid, and I don't think the person is right to ask for it in return. But what's my option in that moment? My option is to hang on to that money and fight, or to know in my heart of hearts that I made a good faith effort, that I've met my end of the contract, and then now I release myself from having to do any thinking in the future about that relationship by just giving the money back. That's the thing they care about, apparently, so that's the thing I will give them. If you want a refund, I will give it. Anyway, we're supposed to be talking about a sales page. Here is how to read a sales page. Number one, find the price. Scroll past all those beautiful images, scroll past all the headline and all the subheads, scroll past the bullet points, scroll past the testimonials, find the price. By the way, if there's no price published, for me, we're done. If you're going to give me a sales page but no price, I'm not sure why we would continue the conversation, because the message you give me is that you don't think I'm capable of evaluating the program in the context of its features, its benefits, and its cost. So there's an indication, and again, this is my opinion, there's an indication that you don't trust me. And you're saying, I can give you the information that I think serves me best, but not the information that I think might hurt the possibility of a yes. So if you do all that scrolling and you still can't find a price, and if it's something like fill out an application, but no price, for me, the relationship is concluded. I need you to respect me. I need you to trust me. If we're going to get into a relationship, I need to know that you want to be transparent and give me all the information that I might need to make the decision without me having to escalate the relationship further. For me, it feels like manipulation. Do I think that makes the person inherently manipulative? No. The person who doesn't put the price on the sales page, I'm not saying they're acting in bad faith. I'm saying they have their own fears, and that's one of the ways their fears are being expressed. It's not a confident person that hides the price. It's a fearful person that hides the price. Okay. If you're afraid of that, I'm just not that sure I want to get into a relationship with you. So for me, you scroll down, you find the price. After you see the price, you've already seen the headline. Even if you scrolled quickly, you saw the headline, you saw the beautiful pictures, you probably saw some testimonials on your way to the price. Now you have the price. Now, in my opinion, what you do is you close that browser tab and you walk away. And you spend time with the price. Why? Because there is a real cost to using money on one thing and not another. One of the things we do in a persuasive setting is we make every effort to show the benefits of the thing such that there's no perceived trade-off in the purchase, meaning you pay me this money and it doesn't actually cost you anything for all these reasons. But it's not true. Trade-offs are a fact of our life. And if I put a dollar here, I can't also put it there. So I'm encouraging you to walk away from the sales page for 24 hours, maybe for a week, and spend time with the price. Ask yourself some questions about it. First and foremost, what else would I do with that money if I weren't doing this with it? I want to make big financial decisions in the context of my next best use of that money. And I want to notice how I negotiate with myself, especially when it comes to trainings. If I'm saying, well, yeah, that $15,000 could pay for a family vacation, it could pay for a car, it could pay down some debt, it could do all these other things, but no, all those things are going to be better after I do the training because then I'll have more money. If you notice yourself having to negotiate hard with yourself, that is a strong sign. It doesn't mean you absolutely shouldn't do that training. It means that you are not finding it to be easily settled about. the cost of the training. Another thing that we're prone to in the industry is we tell people that that unsettled feeling they have is fundamentally untrustworthy because it's based in fear. And I agree that that is one possibility. The other possibility is that person is feeling unsettled because they have a sense, a feeling, you could call it an intuition, that the decision actually is wrong for them, and they just don't have perfect words for describing why yet. As the person offering the training, it's not my job to try to manipulate their emotional state in the way that serves me. If I'm truly an advisor, it's my job to create an environment in which they're able to explore their emotional state in a way that serves them. So if they walk away from my sales page for 24 hours or for 7 days, that's not them being scared, although it might be, that might be part of it. It's them giving themselves some space and time to consider and to parse and to be with their emotions as they think about the decision. If a person comes back to that decision, having processed their own emotions about it, having thought through different scenarios about it, and they make the decision, fantastic, amazing. That's much less likely to be a decision that carries regret later. But I, as a coach, want to give someone an opportunity to feel right in their body. Very coachy thing to say, I know. I want them to have an opportunity to feel right in their body when they're putting their credit card into that form. If they are dysregulated and unsettled as that transaction is happening, the likelihood that they're going to come back later filled with regret is much higher. By the way, as the provider of the training, I don't want a room full of people who had to convince themselves to be in the room. They are going to send the most customer service emails. They're going to have the most concerns during the training. They are going to bring up the cost of the training during the training. They're going to talk about how they're afraid of not getting, quote, the full value. I don't want them in the room. The person that I want in the room when I sell Mark Butler's super expensive training about who knows what is the person who finds it to be the calmest, bordering on boring, sort of course I'm in the room. This was the easiest action I've ever taken. It wasn't an easy decision. I took a long time making the decision, but the action itself to sign up turned out to be quite easy for me. That's the person that I want in the room. We're going to have an amazing relationship. So that is why step one, in my opinion, find the price and walk away and spend time with the price. Oh, side note, ask yourselves how many times you could spend that amount of money without having it meaningfully impact or even harm your life. So for example, if the amount of money that you'll spend on the training even one time creates some amount of jeopardy in your finances, for me, walk away. Because even if the training is great, spending that money has changed the risk profile in your life such that it can only turn out one way and still be a good thing. Now we have pressure. Now we have increased uncertainty. We have potentially more contention in our key relationships. So if you look at a price and say, I'm not sure I can even spend that amount once without creating jeopardy in my finances, walk away. Go save up. Trust me, I've been in the industry over 10 years. Nothing in that training is so time sensitive that you can't walk away, save up, and come back and have missed anything meaningful. Trust me. There's nothing in that training that you can't go experience on your own. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do the training It just means there's nothing in a training that through experience and trial and error that we can't figure out by ourselves. So if the money is going to truly negatively impact our life in the short term, then we can say, instead of incurring that cost, I'm going to incur the cost of trial and error. I'm going to do it knowingly and thoughtfully. I'm going to save up some money, and then I'll come back and do the training if I decide I still want it. You may discover that that training isn't so important a year later. So ask yourself how many times you can spend that amount of money without meaningfully impact or harming your finances. By the way, it's true on the low end of the price spectrum as well. If you could spend that amount of money 1,000 times, 5,000 times, that also calls into question the value of the thing. Because if it's that easy to get into, it might not be that valuable. This is the phenomenon that I've started calling funnel cake. Some of you don't even know what funnel cake is. Funnel cake is like a greasy, delicious, you know, flour sugar combination that you get at the local fair or at the local sporting event, which is just fried dopamine. If a product is for sale inside of a person's sales funnel, I call it funnel cake. Now, I have very good friends and clients who may be upset with me. We may have to talk about funnel cake, but because they sell stuff inside funnels. But I'm not afraid to call into question the value of a thing whose primary purpose is to escalate a person's decision-making toward a bigger yes. So if I know after, again, a decade of seeing sales pages and sales funnels, if I know that the only real purpose of the thing that I'm being offered is to prepare me to receive the next higher ticket offer, then the thing that's in front of me might not be that valuable. I was just on a client call yesterday. We were going through the client's finances, and I saw a charge for $4.95. And I said to her, "Oh, you're in a funnel." She's like, I don't remember what that even was. And I said, "I know what it is. I know based on the price that you're inside of a funnel." So we Googled it. She's like, "Oh yeah, it's this funnel thing." I was like, "Right, I know. I told you it's a funnel." She said, "You're good at this." I said, "It's not that I'm good at this. It's that I've done it 100,000 times." And knowing what I know, having had the experience that I've had, I'll say, "Oh, you're in a funnel." And then I'll say, "What are you stressed out about? What's going on that you're out there in people's funnels?" Because usually when people are in funnels, they're in some sort of state of dysregulation. Yeah, that's my opinion. And now I'm probably going to have to answer for that opinion with some clients in the not too distant future. Anyway, if something is so cheap that you could buy it 1,000 times, I'm not sure how valuable it is. People might say, "Well, don't you like books?" I love books. The thing about a book is I can spend $10 or $20 or $25 and then it lives on my Kindle and it becomes part of my personal knowledge bank, my assets that I can refer to anytime I want. I can drop in there. The technology exists to make that information not just low cost to own, but low cost to access. Funnel cake very often lives behind a login or it's a PDF. I mean, it's low cost to own, but it's high cost to benefit from in a way that books are not. So yeah, I love buying books. I love having a big library. But a big part of the value of that library is its accessibility. Okay, I'm really going on some tangents here. Okay, next up, the next thing we're going to look at on the sales page. I want you to try reading sales pages in plain text only. Here's what you do. You're looking at the sales page. You do select all. Right-click select all or Command A on a Mac or Control A on a PC. And you paste the text only into a Google Doc. Why do you do this? I want to get rid of all the beautiful imagery and the amazing web design. Sorry to any web designers in the audience. Beautiful design and beautiful images play on our lower brains. You know, the woman sees the other woman's amazing hair or fit figure. The man sees the other man's incredible jawline or hairline, which I'll say for no particular reason, it's definitely not a source of insecurity for me. I don't know why you would ask. They see the amazing jawline. They see the amazing hairline. And that is now muddying the water of the decision. Now I'm not evaluating the thing on what transformation it offers me. Why? Because beautiful design and beautiful imagery plays on our lower brains. Now, sometimes we want that. Sometimes just being in the physical presence of a beautiful thing changes our state for the better. In the case of making a financial decision, especially a big financial decision, I at least want to have some awareness around what is working on my lower brain and what is available to my higher brain. So if I take a sales page and I just look at it in plain text, now I'm more confident that it's my higher brain that is involved. So if I extract the text and get the text into a Google Doc, now I've at least minimized the impact of all the beautiful imagery. And now I'm starting to evaluate the thing more in terms of its higher brain value. What is actually being offered to me? How is it actually going to transform me and my experience? After I'm working with plain text, I go a step further, or I would encourage you to go a step further and delete the main headline and delete the testimonials. I know, this is crazy. Hear me out. You've all probably seen videos or read books or heard podcasts that say that in a persuasive setting, the headline is the most persuasive thing. If that's true, then I want to delete it. Because the headline is not long enough to hold enough information to actually help me make a more informed decision, it's going to play on something in my lower brain. Now, is that always true? No. Someday when you see Mark Butler's super expensive training and it's a sales page, it will probably say something like, "Welcome to Mark Butler's super expensive training." And then the price will be beneath it. And then beneath that, there will be, "If you'd like to talk about it, let me know." I mean, that will probably be the whole sales page. So a headline can't contain enough information to really help an informed decision. And if the research says it's highly persuasive, then my conclusion is it must be a little bit, not manipulative, that's not the right word, but distracting. If so few words carry so much weight, I want them out, and I want what's left over to have to do the heavy lifting. Now, why am I going to delete the testimonials? Because come on. If you've written sales pages, you know that most of the time, the clients themselves didn't even write the testimonials. Usually, the smart marketer says, "You're not good at this. I'll write your testimonial for you. I want you to read it and tell me if it's true, according to your experience, but I'm not going to let you write it. You're bad at this." So the testimonials tend to be low information. Here's what I would encourage you to employ instead. There's a hack that you can use when you're buying books, by the way. You ignore the 5-star reviews and you ignore the 1-star reviews. You go to the 3-star reviews. The 3-star reviews will usually speak to the benefits of the book, and they will also acknowledge where the book could have been better. "Well, I liked this about it, but I didn't love that." That's useful to the person making a decision. I have found that when I focus on 3-star reviews for books, I become even more likely to buy the book because I feel more confident that I know what the book actually is. So testimonials on sales pages are like 5-star reviews. They are cherry-picked and they are safe to ignore. By the way, angry social media threads or angry community forums about a person or a program, those are like 1-star reviews, and they can be safely ignored, in my opinion. Because what you'll find if you take any time, which weirdly I have, if you go into some of these communities where people are railing against coaches and their programs, what you'll find is that the people who participate in those, oftentimes, not always, sometimes people are in there just hurting and wanting to get some validation in their pain, and I actually completely understand that. But there are some people who post in those communities where if you click on their profile and you go sort of follow them around the community, you discover that they're mad about everything. They're mad about every single thing. And if a person is mad about everything and railing and raging against everything, their opinion's not worth very much to me. So I ignore them. So in that spirit, I delete the testimonials because those are the 5-star reviews that are cherry-picked and probably handcrafted, and I ignore the 1-star reviews because they're mostly just mad for being mad. And I want to find 3-star reviews. Now, it's really hard to find 3-star reviews for certifications, coaching programs, masterminds. So there's some work to be done here in trying to have conversations, have 1, 2, 3 conversations with people who've actually participated and listen to what they call the pros and cons. Because we want to be psychologically consistent, it's very hard for us to say that spending a bunch of money on a thing was a bad move. So we work very hard to rationalize and justify ourselves after the fact. And since that's fundamental to our psychology, my psychology, your psychology, if someone asks me, would I make that decision again? Would you spend that money again? And if I say the truth is, I probably wouldn't. That's an expensive thing for me to admit, and therefore more trustworthy, because I had to go against basic psychology to say it. But if I say to you, okay, here's the thing. There was a lot of it that I loved. Here were the few things that I really thought were weak. I didn't like them. Here's where I think that the program did not live up to the promise that the sales page made. If a person can say that clearly and calmly, that's an incredibly useful information set for you who are trying to make the decision of whether to do it in the first place. So come on, if you're going to spend $10,000 and $15,000 and $20,000 and $25,000, you're going to tell me that it's not worth finding and having conversations with a couple of people who've already done it? And then within those conversations, you can also kind of ignore the 5-stars and the 1-stars and look for the 3-star material where they say, this was the good stuff. This is where it could have been improved. Overall, I'm pretty happy with it. That's going to help you make a much more informed decision. So, plain text only, delete the headline, delete the testimonials. What's left? Most of what will be left will be bullet points. We all know the bullet points we find on sales pages. Bullet points tend to follow a feature benefit model. You will get this, and here's how that benefits you. Great. I think these should be, can be, the most useful for helping you make your decision. What I'll encourage you to do is take each of those bullet points and ask yourself some questions about it. What is the feature? What is their proposed or claimed benefit about that feature? And then how does that compare to what I know is most important and useful to me today? Wherever I am in my journey, I'm encouraging you to take a little extra time and ask yourself, what is offered? Why does it matter? And does that benefit still seem compelling given what I know about my current situation? Now, you might find yourself in a situation where you don't know what you don't know. My opinion would be that's not the time to whip out the credit card. My opinion would be that you're better off acknowledging that you don't know what you don't know and going and discovering what you don't know by using whatever, YouTube, books, free content, but approaching all of that with a critical thinking, critical as in careful, thoughtful, not negative, approaching all of that with a critical thinking view and saying, what is it? Why does it matter? And how does it relate to my current situation? For any given feature, by the way, you want to be looking at if there's text offered in the thing, what reason do I have to believe that the text is more useful and more consumable than what I would get from a Kindle book? If it's video, what reason do I have to believe that it's more useful and more consumable than YouTube video? If it's audio, what podcasts are there? And if it's coaching, I really have to ask myself, do I believe that sitting in a room with somewhere between 5 and 500 other people, receiving nearly no attention from the coach, I have to have a way of believing that that's more useful than hiring my own one-on-one coach? There are situations where I believe that's the case. I've experienced them when I've consumed certain trainings. But I do at least want to ask the question, because there is one-on-one coaching available from all kinds of coaches out there. So I have to ask myself, in what situation does it make sense for me to pay the same or more money for much less attention and personalization? Now, the standard answer that we give is, well, we benefit from observing other people's experiences. And I completely agree. We just want to make sure that that's what we're expecting and that's what we're getting in the program. Because if I go into a program saying, I really want to benefit from other people's insights, I want to benefit from other people's experiences, but then we find in the program that the facilitation is not done in such a way that that actually happens, where we're all kind of sitting in our Zoom room, we're all staring at our screen, we're not really having an opportunity to make a contribution, we're not really having an opportunity to engage with the other participants. Well, now I have potentially a lecture and listen situation that I have to admit to myself is lower value than my alternative, which would have been hiring a one-on-one coach and getting all the attention for myself. So for every bullet point, for every feature and proposed benefit, I've got to say to myself, what is the feature? What is the claimed benefit? And what do I think of that potential benefit in the context of what I already know about myself and my situation? There's a thing that happens where people will buy a program based on one promised feature and benefit. So they'll see a list of 10 bullet points. One of those bullet points will be so compelling to them that they make the purchase based on that. Do I think that's wrong? I don't think it's wrong. Do I think it's higher risk? I do. My reminder for people when they're approaching a decision in this way is, don't forget, there's a ton of protein in milkshakes. And what I mean by that is, if you look at a milkshake and say, I'm going to buy it because it has all the protein, you'd say, there's actually ways to get that protein that don't come with all the carbs and fat, or with fewer carbs and fat. So you have to ask yourself, am I buying a milkshake right now? Or am I having, you know, chicken and broccoli? Which is a ridiculous thing for me to say because I'm not choosing the chicken and broccoli the vast majority of the time. But I'm being more honest than I ever have been about the fact that the protein in a milkshake is buried in a bunch of carbs and fat. And I think that happens with people buying trainings in the coaching world. This suggests that you ought to have your own hypothesis about what is true about you and about your coaching practice or whatever training you're considering consuming. It suggests that you ought to have a hypothesis about, this is who I am, this is what I want, this is what I care about, and these are the pain points I have that I'm actually trying to solve right now, so that we don't get distracted by shiny sales pages and let the person who wrote the sales page tell us who we are and what we care about and what our pain is right now. Because if they're a very good copywriter, they can do that. In the course of one sales page or one sales sequence, they can persuade you to buy into a new version of yourself and a new definition of your current circumstances and a new belief in the solutions. The tricky thing about our world is everything I just said, I could probably say in another setting, wow, that's great. It's great to offer people a new view of themselves. It's great to suggest new definitions for their problems and new potential solutions. In another setting, I'd be calling that great leadership. So all of this has to be done together. I want to consider the price. I want to consider the features. I want to ignore the headline and the testimonials. I want to evaluate the proposed individual benefits. And I want to measure all of that against what I believe to be true about myself. And once I've done that, then I can acknowledge the new version of me that is being offered to me and the new way of thinking and the new solutions to the old problem. I can do all of that with clear thoughts and settled emotions. And having done that, I'm so much less likely to regret the decision that I make. And so much more likely to go into that training energetic, happy, and enthusiastic. It's going to have its bumps in the road. There's no perfect training program, and I'm not suggesting that anybody has to create the perfect training program. But if we start the relationship in the right way, I think we drastically reduce the likelihood of regret. We can see how that's good for clients. If you're a coach, if you're a trainer, this is also good for the brand. I talked earlier about these insane Reddit threads where, I mean, I have some commentary on some people's way of being in their training businesses. I've got my opinions, even about past clients. I can say, well, I wouldn't do that. I don't love how that was done. But these Reddit threads are so absurd. And I think part of the reason they go to such a crazy place is that the well-intentioned trainer offering what they're offering, they didn't consider the fact that the better you get at selling, the more likely you are to sell someone who's mad at you later, because you persuaded them harder than they were able to persuade themselves. And at some point, they're going to come back and want to punish you for it. A brand's best move is to sell with a little bit more care and even a little bit more caution, so that if somebody does make it into the room, they're happy to be there and they're very, very unlikely to go out screaming into the world about what a horrible person you are. That's the worst case scenario of all this. It's more prevalent, I think, in 2024 than it's ever been, because there are more places for it to happen than it's ever happened. And I think it all comes from a person who thinks their job is to persuade at all cost. And I would rather have a person in my program who was persuaded in a pretty mediocre way, and they said yes anyway. Because now I think we've entered into the relationship in a healthy way. Does anybody want to date a pickup artist? Maybe. I guess I've been out of the dating game for 22 years, so maybe this isn't the metaphor for me to reach for. But the fact that a person can be incredibly skilled at getting into a romantic interaction does not mean they're a person you want a relationship with. So if a person has an absolutely incredible funnel and sales page, you have to ask yourself, is this a pickup artist? Or is it a person with whom I want to be in a long-term relationship? It's just food for thought. All I'm trying to do is create some counterbalance in an industry where there is so much powerful persuasion, but maybe not quite enough acknowledgement that these decisions can be made a little more slowly, a little more thoughtfully. And frankly, there probably should be fewer yeses in the industry. There probably should be a little bit of a balancing out where some of the people who are buying these trainings would be happier if they didn't. So that's how to read a sales page. I hope it's useful to you, and I'll talk to you next time.